Right. Well, the last year or so has seen a whole flurry of Leonardo attributions. I think there was a back painting on the Child with Saint Anne, and there was a Florence terracotta that came up. And I was wondering, when you heard about La Bella Principessa, was there something different that particularly struck you about it?
Well, initially you get emails or letters or whatever saying, I have a new Leonardo, or I've got some kind of new Leonardo secret. And I think, oh, no, for heaven's sake. And since the dreaded Da Vinci Code, I get them weekly at least, sometimes more than that. So this is just one of many when I received the initial email saying, you know, I have this, which I think is a new Leonardo portrait. I thought, oh dear, you know, this is going to be another bout of painful correspondence. But the digital file came through, and I thought, oh, well, that's, you know, it warrants looking at least. So that was the starting point, that it wasn't simply something to be a polite reply saying no chance.
What are some of the more radical suggestions that you've had about particular Leonardo works?
Oh, one of the really funny ones from the people I call the Leonardo loonies was that the Mona Lisa is a Titian of a Honduran princess, and this comes with an enormous body of documentation. So it's absolutely extraordinary, and they assemble these great fat folios proving absolutely nothing. But no, Leonardo attracts lunatics to a degree that no other figure does, not Shakespeare or Goethe or Dante or Newton or any of the great cultural figures. He's in the league of his own for sheer insanity.
I think my favorite is the Shroud of Turin, as a self-portrait of Leonardo.
Yeah, well, the Mona Lisa has also been a self-portrait of Leonardo, so yeah, it gets around. But having received the digital file, I thought, well, it is at least worth seeing this, which one wouldn't normally do, as most of them are not worth the time. And it was at that point in Zurich, in a bank vault or in a storage facility, which is where most of these sort of valuable pictures that are not in particular collections tend to be. And I was making a television program for an American producer. So I was going to be in Zurich anyway. It was I don't even accept expenses, because once you take money for doing an attribution, then your opinion is being bought in a way. So I said, well, you know, in 6 months' time, I can be out there to look at this. So I did turned up, and it was in this storage facility, and sort of men bring it out from storage with sort of big shoulders, no necks, you know, really scary guys. And it was placed in a special large room for us to look at. And I looked at it and thought, this is actually a different league from all the others. And you're still very cautious. You know, you really don't want to say jump at it, because once you start believing something too firmly, you can get all the evidence looks right. So all the time you're dragging back and saying, you know, let's see what's wrong with this. Let's see why it's not a Leonardo. And you have to retain that skepticism, which trains as a scientist, in a sense. It's how you're trained, that you always scrutinize the data and you never jump to conclusions. But anyway, that was seeing it in the original. And that then I thought, well, this is worth researching this seriously. You know, doing the technical analysis, doing all the historical research, seeing if we could place it, identify the sitter, how does it fit with Leonardo?
I believe Timothy Clifford, who is the director of the National Gallery until 2006, had recently found a Michelangelo, or identified a Michelangelo rather, and when they asked him about sort of his old-fashioned connoisseurial methods, he said something like, "Can I not recognize my own wife across the breakfast table?" And that was something that struck him when he first saw the Michelangelo. So, do you have any thoughts about connoisseurship prior to doing the forensic analysis and that kind of scientific detailing?
In a way, that first jump of recognition, which, yes, it is a bit like being able to recognize a member of your family 200 yards away without you being able to say why you can do that. That was a starting point for me, if you didn't get that, and it's a kind of interior thing, it sort of grabs you. But it's not enough. I like to get all the science evidence lined up, but I also like to adopt other criteria, saying, does this organically belong? Does it tell us as much about Leonardo as we're trying to bring Leonardo to the portrait? So I like that big contextual support. But at the end of the day, if it collapses visually as a Leonardo, no amount of evidence helps. So it's a starting point and a confirmation. It's not sufficient into itself, but without that it goes. And any bit of it, if you get something in the technical evidence which is wrong, something in the historical evidence, say her costume is all wrong, comes out wrongly, then one negative bit collapses the whole case. So it's part of this jigsaw of evidence.
Was there any piece of evidence at which point you became sure? Was there any one factor that was a real deciding factor for you?
There's no point you can identify. It's cumulative. And since you're always sort of trying to pull back and not make assumptions and then make the evidence do what you want it to do, there is that sense that it gradually accumulates. And at a certain point, it's a bit like a well-designed piece of furniture. So you've got a cabinet with drawers in it. Gradually you get four legs rather than two legs, and you gradually find the drawers all fit in and out, and it all holds together, and the whole edifice is solid, so that none of the drawers stick, and it's not got three legs and intermittently falls over. So it's that sort of construction involving all the evidence. In the old days, you would have really just had connoisseurship and documentation. Now we've got all this science, it makes a terrific difference. It doesn't prove it's by Leonardo, but it eliminates possibilities like it being a forgery, etc. And it tells you a lot about the medium, and the medium in this case is important because it's on vellum. We didn't know that Leonardo worked on vellum, but once I started looking at Leonardo and vellum, which is basically parchment, it's from a calf or a kid, I think in this case, or sheep. It's animal skin, which we got no drawings by Leonardo on vellum, on animal skin. But once you start looking at Leonardo, you can find references to his interest in this as a medium. So that becomes important. And all these things add up. So there's no point at which you say, that is absolutely, absolutely it.
I think the point about it being vellum is really interesting, and I wondered if, because there's no other works that we know of in which Leonardo worked on vellum, it made a difference in terms of attribution according to technique, whether he's using a different technique here because of the material, or if that made it harder. Or
in one's initial reaction, you see a drawing on ink, coloured chalks, with also ink washes on vellum. The initial reaction, of course, is Leonardo didn't do that. It's one reason why it's probably not a forgery, because a forger wouldn't take something which has got that obstacle. So I then started looking at the evidence of drawings in coloured chalk, and Leonardo picked it up from the French artists, who used it in a very sober way and developed it to a very high level. And his pupils, people like Boltraffio, Luini, all start using coloured chalks. The Isabella d'Este drawing by Leonardo in the Louvre is partly coloured in chalk. But I also found in a rather famous Leonardo document, which is called the Ligny Memorandum, which was a draft of a memorandum, partly in a sort of code, to a French Count Ligny, who was with the French kings. He was a leader of French forces in 1494 and again 1499. And there's this Ligny memorandum. There's a very puzzling bit in it which says, get from Jean de Paris the method of dry colouring. And he talks about Jean's book of box of colours. And he talks about how can we get many sheets, singles and doubles. And once you're thinking about vellum and coloured chalks on vellum, all this falls into place. Jean Parial was the court artist to Charles VIII and later to Louis XII, was in Milan with the French invaders. Leonardo met Jean. There are a number of references. Jean was a kind of engineer and a uomo universale. He was one of these all-round people like Leonardo, though at a slightly lesser level. And Leonardo obviously was going off to ask Jean de Paris about how to do things on vellum, not orthodox manuscript illumination, how to use dry colours, which are pastels. So that memorandum, which had always seemed a bit random, that little bit in the Ligny memorandum, suddenly fell into place. And a piece of evidence which had been lurking there rather unscrutinised, which we didn't really need to think about Leonardo and vellum. But the other aspect is you then think, well, why would he do it on vellum? And in that case, you begin to think about the function of it. Now, the Sforza princesses, as I'm calling them, the inner circle, the aristocratic ladies in the Duke's court, they're not technically princesses, but they are in the vernacular sense. They received at key events in their life, particularly marriage, presentation volumes of poems, beautifully written in vellum. And some of the poems survive, some of the volumes survive. Very few of them, but there are other sort of things which people lose interest in. The poems are not much good, so nobody collects them for poems, so it's a kind of accidental survival. And the obvious reason for making this is so that you would have a portrait to go in with the book of poems. So at least there's a hypothetical model which would say that these laudatory poems describing the princess's beautiful eyes and roseate lips and all the conventions of court poetry and so on. There were poets employed at the court, including a fellow Tuscan of Leonardo, Bernardo Bellincioni, a semi-aristocratic poet, Gaspari Visconti, another one, Niccolo da Correggio, who was employed also by Isabella d'Este. So there were little gangs of these poets producing this pretty dreadful late Petrarchian love poetry. And I think at some point, obviously somebody decided to rescue the portrait from a book of not very distinguished poetry.
Is there a correlation between the formality of the portrait and its use in one of these codices?
Yeah, what I realised, it had been obvious, but I didn't kind of pick it up, was that all the Sforza court portraits of the inner circle, the Duke's family, are all in profile. Now, we know two Leonardo portraits of Milanese women, the ones we know best. There's the so-called definitely Cecilia Gallerani, but the lady with the ermine in Krakow. The lady holding the ermine and smiling, and looking out of the picture, but in three-quarter face. And there's the so-called La Belferoniere in the Louvre, which is almost certainly Lucrezia Crivelli. And these are both the Duke's mistresses. And they're not portrayed in profile. So there's an issue of what in the Renaissance you call decorum, i.e. good manners, that if you were a princess, you were in profile. If it was a more intimate portrait, not a public portrait, as it were, you could be more relaxed. So what would be bad manners in a portrait of one of the aristocrats, you could relax. And obviously the Mona Lisa is like that. It's an intimate work. It's for Mona Lisa's husband, basically. He never got it, but there's an issue of decorum.
I think it's interesting thinking about Leonardo's other female portraits of the period, how in quite a few of them there seem to be indicators of the sitter's identity in quite fundamental terms, her name or things like the Ginevra de Benci in the tree, or her moral characteristics, this sort of thing. And this one doesn't seem to have that.
It hasn't got the obvious symbolism of the ermine. And the ermine is a symbol of purity and moderation, which you may consider slightly of the Duke's mistress, but these are bits of symbolic rhetoric and not no more than that. But there are clear signs that she is a Sforza, inner member of the Sforza circle, a Sforza princess, if you like. And that is the costume and above all the hairstyle. and a portrait you will know down the road in Christchurch here. There is a portrait almost certainly by Leonardo's colleague Ambrogio de Predis of Beatrice d'Este, who was the Duke's wife. And married young, as they're all married young, these brides, expected to produce children. And Beatrice died young, like most of them, with regular childbirth is a dangerous business and for young people and young women in the Renaissance. Anyway, there she is in the Christchurch portrait in profile, and she's got what became an absolutely standard inner aristocratic women's hairstyle. It's a great bound pigtail, I think ferociously uncomfortable probably, and requires what we call a hair extension. And it's bound very tightly at the top, and you can see the bound ribbon constricting this coazzone, as it's called. And it came via Spain, but Beatrice decreed that the princesses, as I'm calling them, would wear this. Anyway, it's bound very tightly, then it's bound more loosely with a spiral ribbon, and the hair sort of bulges out between the bits of the ribbon very beautifully, which is very typical Leonardesque touch, which Ambrogio de Predis doesn't do. You know, his coazzone on the Beatrice just goes down like a tube. You know, it's well enough, and it says I'm a coazzone, but there's no sense of the inner structure of it. But that shows that it's one of this very tightly grouped inner circle of sitters, and you can begin by a process of elimination to take out who it might not be, at least amongst the ones who would be portrayed in that way.
I think the comparison with the Beatrice portrait is interesting. One of the things that's striking about the difference, I think, is that Beatrice has all her fine jewellery and very expensive ornament, and in the Principessa she doesn't. Is that potentially because it's commemorative rather than painted for a marriage? Does that support that?
Yeah. Well, one of the puzzling things, the costume has got the kind of knot designs, which we know is associated with Leonardo, so that's fine. But one of the more puzzling things, in fact, almost the only puzzling thing about it for me, is the fact that she doesn't have pearls. The Ludovico and the court delighted in pearls. Ludovico Il Moro, the Duke of Milan, had probably the best collection of pearls of anyone. It was almost a fetish, and he used to give away pearl necklaces to wife and to niece and so on, and she's not got one. But as I began to eliminate possibilities for who this was, I lighted on one potential sitter, and this was Bianca Sforza, not to be confused with Bianca Maria, who was Ludovico's niece and married Maximilian, the Holy Roman Emperor. These court names are rather painful, as you always, women, a limited number of names are used in each generation. Anyway, Ludovico had an illegitimate child. We don't know when she was born, but we can more or less work it out, and called Bianca. He went to enormous trouble to legitimize her, and at the age of 13, maybe 14, but probably 13, she was married to the commander of Ludovico's forces, who was an aristocrat called Galeazzo Sanseverino. And within 4 months, she was dead. She had it was recorded, and the doctors said she had a passione del stomaco, some kind of, maybe an ectopic pregnancy, maybe, she's expected to produce children straight away. It may have been too much for her as a 13-year-old and childbearing at that point. Anyway, she died within 4 months, and if you think about it, this is a portrait of a very young woman, just on the edge of maturity, at the age when these women tended to be married. It was a kind of life of luxury, but also a life of rather enforced, not enslavement, but certainly a very circumscribed social and reproductive role. I'm more and more inclined to think the portrait is for a volume of posthumous poems. It was only 4 months anyway, and the poems may have been ready for her marriage, but it would explain that she is her accoutrement, I am a Milanese princess, but it's not celebratory. It's not over the top. The costume is relatively subdued, and there are no pearls, often they have pearls hanging from their the knotted hair. They're sort of dripping in pearls, as it were, and she's not, so I suspect. I can't prove it's Bianca, but you can take out the other Milanese leading women one by one, because we know what they look like. And it becomes a nice romantic story as well, sort of Romeo and Juliet stuff, this sort of young, the violins are playing, and I don't want to be too romantic about it, but it's it adds a poignancy to the if you... And I think there's a very good possibility it is Bianca.
Leading on from the idea of the portrait potentially not being drawn from life, but after her death, do the pentimenti support that, or are they characteristic of Leonardo's kind of method of working in general? Or
what we found is, and the scientific examination was already underway by the time the portrait crossed my path, Pascal Cotte in Paris, who runs a company called Lumiere Technology, has got an amazing method of photographing a picture called multispectral scanning. And this consists of taking 11 photographs across different spectral bands, which means that you can do that at a with a definition which is way beyond ordinary photography. It includes ultraviolet at the far end of the non-visible spectrum and three infrared bands at the other end. So you get this extraordinary visual survey of the picture with this multispectral scanning, which produces both enormously high resolution, but which allows us to see a lot of details. It also, the infrared goes through the image and you can see things under the surface, which we can come back to, and the ultraviolet tends to show pick up things added later. But just looking and zooming in on the compounded image, you can begin to see pentimenti changes of mind, not big ones, but enough to show that the artist is manoeuvring. The ones in the profile are very delicate. Leonardo sort of tended to caress these profiles, and he keeps them alive. Many artists, if they go over a profile twice or three times, it dies. Leonardo manages to keep that extraordinary vitality of line even when he's caressing it three or four times to make it the shape he wants. But then there are bigger pentimenti. There are ones particularly in the hair, the hairstyle, call her cap at the back. Originally it was much bigger and much fatter, so there are some quite dramatic pentimenti, and we can see the one at the back of her head that Leonardo has used a kind of rubber, probably breadcrumbs sort of gathered together to take out something that was drawn in chalk before it was inked in. Yeah, so there's a series of pentimenti. The technical analysis also thrown up a lot of other things. One of the things it threw up was a fingerprint. It also showed under the surface, and there's been quite a lot of surface restoration, that Leonardo, or the artist, let's say, had used that bit of his hand to blend the pigments. We've been doing a lot of technical analysis of Leonardo's, and most pictures... There's even a little bit in the Mona Lisa, but most of the earlier pictures, he used his hands and fingers a lot. So when he was wishing to blend something, he would sometimes use his fingers, particularly he used that bit of his hand, and it's always the right hand as far as we can tell, because he's a left-hander. So he's sort of putting some, you can imagine, some pastels in, and he wants to blend them, so he just gives it a little caress with that bit of his hand. And under the restoration, and this is something that a forger wouldn't do, so they wouldn't necessarily know about that, because it's fairly new knowledge, we found evidence of this handprint technique being used. In the left margin, we found the tip of a fingerprint. It's not like you'd want, if you're Sherlock Holmes, you haven't got a great big pad with a whirl in the middle, but we've got that little top bit of the finger. And this I got Paul Biraud in Montreal, who is the world expert in fingerprints in paintings. He looked at that. Fingerprints is highly technical. You know, what you and I can see is not very much, basically, because we don't know what we're looking for. Anyway, he looked at that and said, there's a very characteristic pattern there. We've got a little longitudinal island amongst that, which relates to other bits of the fingerprint. And he said, are there other Leonardo fingerprints? And I said, Leonardo paintings are full of fingerprints, which we're increasingly realising. And the one that yielded the best lot was the unfinished St. Jerome in the Vatican. Since it's unfinished, prima facie, you think these are Leonardo fingerprints, was they're not accidental. They're used for applying the paint. And this is fairly early Leonardo, as you know, so it's unlikely some student is doing this finger dragging in the paint, in the underpainting of an unfinished picture. And lo and behold, this characteristic of this fingertip with the little island relating to these other points came up in this picture. It's not conclusive evidence, it's part of the evidence. Of course, the press love it, but it isn't half helpful having that.
You were speaking earlier about the characteristic left-handed hatching. Could you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, Leonardo is a left-hander, and obviously if you're left-handed you can do it in different ways, but if you're hatching in very parallel hatching to make the background, and Leonardo more or less invented this method, probably for anatomical drawing, of drawing something on a sheet of paper and then hatching up to the edge of it with this meticulous parallel hatching, which makes it like a specimen. What it does, it sort of pushes the object you're portraying forward and in front of the plane of the drawing or whatever. And he does that in a series of skull drawings at Windsor, first of all, in 1489. And he takes the skulls, and as a left-hander, he goes down, but he also goes up the other way. He starts from the contours. You don't want to go across the edge, so he'll start there and he'll go up like that. Now, a right-hander, that's not convenient. The right-hander does that. Obviously, you can move your hand the other way, but the natural movement, if you're doing parallel shading, is very characteristic. And this is done exactly as Leonardo does. You can look at the way the pen moves next to the contour to make this very fine grid of parallel shading, and it's absolutely what Leonardo does. And even if somebody tries to copy that a right-hander, they don't do it very well. But interestingly, there are other aspects of work on that which is clearly right-handed. If you look at the image and zoom in on the image using the multispectral scanning, and those we can show a restoration. A lot of the knot work has been reinforced, and you can tell, you know, if somebody's got a loaded brush to reinforce something and they do that, they're right-handed. You know, it's not magic. So you can get a clear sense. But so we've got an original work with some right-handed restoration in it.
I find it fascinating that the skin detail is coming through the vellum, the surface of the vellum, which must have been fun for him to play with the new material in that way.
Yeah, Leonardo got this idea, and obviously had talked to Jean Perréal, the French artist, about how you might do this, but characteristically he takes it way beyond what the French were doing. The French specialised in these rather gently coloured, a bit of colour in the lips and maybe in the flesh and a bit of costume. What Leonardo has done is, in a sense, a painting in pastels, and then reinforced it in a way the French didn't do, with ink washes, with extra ink work and so on. So it's a fully pictorial rendering. So characteristically, you know, Leonardo never does anything by halves. When he goes into something, he takes it as far as he can. And one of the things he did very brilliantly is to use the natural base colour of the vellum to shine through. So you can get a shine coming through the hair or the eye and the iris of the eye, which is just wonderful. It glows. And that's not because of pigment. It's because he's allowed the base colour to come through. He does that with white gesso, white plaster priming on a panel. He'll glaze over that rather than mask the white. That's to say, he'll put on a translucent pigment so all the light comes through off the background. So it's very characteristic. It's a very brilliant use, and nobody had done that before, and really nobody is capable of doing it afterwards.
Can I ask you about the function of the portrait, which obviously isn't a portrait in the sense of the Mona Lisa, but with this book of poems, when it would have been looked at and by who?
Well, we have one very nice record of at one of the great festae with a great staged performance by Leonardo, one of the Tuscan poets, that Apollo descended from the stage and presented the princess in question with a little bound book of poems, beautifully inscribed. You know, these are luxury objects, very expensive. You know, they're absolutely luxury objects. Now, that one doesn't survive, and the one which Leonardo was in, if it was in a bound codex of this sort. And we can actually see where it was cut out, incidentally. We can see the knife marks down the side, which slip off at one point, so it's clearly been cut out of a bound volume. We've got two surviving volumes of poetry. One is bound in copper, so a very, very fancy thing. Another one is bound in vellum, in velvet, and is on purple vellum. So these are, you know, really, really luxury products. Could be a bit kitsch, I suspect, in their extreme form. And if I'm right, and this isn't a volume of poetry, and of course it would make a lovely frontispiece or somewhere in the volume accompanying these poems, evoking the young woman's beauty and her innocence, etc., etc. So, these would be presented to the young woman in question. They probably then would go on a shelf. You know, you'd look at them, they'd be delightful, but they'd be part of a kind of suite of aristocratic things, and unlike jewellery, you couldn't wear them. So they're probably relatively useless in that sense. So they lived for the moment of presentation, would be wondrous, might be looked at. But one reason you wouldn't know about this portrait is to have a Leonardo portrait sitting in a library in a book of not very brilliant poetry. It just kind of gets lost. So we can get that hypothetical function for it. What would be really nice, of course, would be to discover the book it's cut out of, but the chances are it was cut out of the book because somebody wanted the portrait but didn't want the book, so we can imagine it was probably the book of poems was ditched at that point.
So, Martin, you were saying at the beginning that you had a sense of immediate recognition that made this painting, this picture, different from all of the other things that you had seen and the different attributions that have been presented to you. After you've looked at it more closely and gone through different methods of analysis, how do you feel about the picture now?
Yeah, well, you go through all this process of looking for negatives, which you have to keep doing. But at a certain point, it all adds up, and the delight that I had in when I first saw it has been reinforced enormously, and I'm absolutely convinced. I think it's rock solid, but above all, it is thrilling to look at. It's been restored as, you know, it's an old object, and we're not going to look very good after 500 years. So, but it is just thrilling still. It has an enormous freshness, a delicacy, and when you look at it in itself, this extraordinary presence. I've seen the Mona Lisa out of its frame. I've seen all the Louvre pictures out of their frames. I've seen the Cecilia Gallerani out of its frame. And all of them have, not mystically inclined, but all of them have a kind of inner life that the sitters seem to live. And very few artists can do that. Rembrandt can do it. Bernini can do it in sculpture. But the numbers who get that uncanny sense of a presence embedded in the picture, a living presence. And this very much has that. It has the delicacy, it has the vibrancy, which I think will give generations of viewers enormous, enormous pleasure.